HDRadioNetwork.com.
Climb aboard and strap in. It's time for the Racing Rewind Show with your hosts, Glenn Carcitti and Mike Saluca. Bringing you all the action from the Southern England tracks each and every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Heard only on the Victory Lane Radio Network, presented by Anytime Realty. Let Mike and Glenn tell you the way it really happened out there at your favorite track. Strap in. Here we go.
Welcome to the Racing Rewind Show. I'm your host, Glenn Carcitti. Alongside is a special guest co-host tonight from Sid's Vault Productions, Sid, Tom DiMaggio. Mike Saluca had a little problem tonight with the four-letter word. And no, it's not wife, it's work. He had to stay late at work, so he won't be able to join us tonight, but he'll be back next week. So we got Sid filling in, and how's it going tonight, Sid?
It's going all right, man. I'm getting ready to dive back into the editing booth for my Speedball documentary project, so it's good to take a little break, talk to some people on the Rewind Show.
Yeah, we have a great show lined up for you tonight. We have racing author, journalist, writer, all-around aficionado of our sport, Mark Bones Borsier will join us. And then later in the show, we have a local boy done good is probably the best way to put it. Tony Hirschman III, son of Tony Hirschman Jr., obviously, brother of Matt Hirschman. In case listeners might, some of you might not know, he's the spotter for Kyle Busch in the Sprint Cup Series and also the spotter for William Byron in the Cramping World Truck Series. And it's been a long road and a long journey to get to the point where he's at. And we'll talk to him about that and much, much more when he comes on later in the show. Well, Sid, Whelen Modified Tour Silly Season is about full throttle right now. Four different rumors, I guess, basically came true this week. First, Jeff Goodale in the 46, stepping out of the 46 car and putting Woody Pitcat in as the driver. Then Donnie Leah stepping out of the 8 car, the 8 team, I guess, basically dissolving. Jimmy Blewett will not be back in the Mystic Missile number 4 next year. And just released a few minutes ago, as a matter of fact, no concrete plans with the number 44 Tineo Motorsports car. So that leaves Bobby Santos out there searching for a ride. What's your thoughts on all of that?
Wow. Yeah, I didn't come across that last minute. Yeah, I mean, those are all big names. I mean, I think the rumor mill was had all of those in it before the season ended. And, you know, the Mystic Missile, as legendary of a car as that is, it seems to be the always gets top billing on silly season. It's kind of an annual affair lately. I don't know. I mean, you know, Leah said he'd still make some, you might see him make some starts. And I think Blewett alluded to the same thing. And, you know, the Goodale, I mean, that's great for Woody. You know, the Goodale guys, they always bring good equipment. I think he'll do well. And but it definitely looks like you know, I actually don't know if this whole quote unquote merger thing is why we're having all these teams dissolve. But you know, I actually don't think it's really going to change much in terms of, you know, maybe one race will be down south, but I don't think the schedule's going to change that much. But it does look like everyone's waiting to see what the schedule's going to be before there's any concrete plans laid out for 2017.
Yeah, there's so many rumors flying around about what the schedule is going to be. Of course, obviously nothing factual or concrete. I've heard everything up to 19 races. I've heard you know, 7 or 8 races down south and the rest up here. Just you know, a lot of different things flying around. You know, and another thing, too, that I failed to mention in this whole silly season thing, Chase Dowling is another driver who's out there in search of a ride, Sid.
Yeah, I saw that he's even looking for an SK ride, and that really stings because, you know, Chase is doing really good. He's a young kid, and it stinks to see somebody that young with that much talent in the position that he's in. You know, I don't know what the answer is. I'll be surprised if we get a lot of events that have the same core group of people. I just think those days are long past us. It's not when the tour started, late 80s, early 90s, when they had a huge amount. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out.
Okay, well, our first guest of the evening is on the line. Bones Borsir, welcome to the show, Bones.
Good to talk to you guys, always.
Great to have you. You were in attendance at the 2016 NEAR Hall of Fame induction banquet this past Sunday. Randy LaJoy, Ricky Craven, Jerry Marquis, Ken Bouchard, the late Moose Hewitt, Dwight Jarvis, and Jackie Arute and Noki Fanora were all inducted. Your thoughts on that particular class and their individual accomplishments in the sport?
Well, it's always one of my favorite days of the year. I always say my two favorite events of the year are the Indy 500 and the NEAR Hall of Fame banquet. One, just because it's such a big deal nationally, and the other because it's such a big deal in my home region. And of this particular group, I mean, it was a pretty diverse group. I mean, you had guys like, you know, Kenny Bouchard and Jerry Marquis, who did a little bit of modified racing and also some late model racing. You had guys like Ricky Craven and Randy LaJoy, who, although they did other things, their tickets into the Hall of Fame were written out, you know, by what they did on the old NASCAR North Tour in Randy's case and in the Busch North Series in Ricky Craven's case. Noki Fanora was as exciting a race driver as I've ever seen. When he would come to New England to run the midgets in the days when NEAR was, you know, getting a pretty star-studded field at every race. I mean, Noki was, in my mind, as much fun to watch as anybody. Moose Hewitt certainly had a lot of big days at places like Stafford and Thompson, obviously most known for what he did at Waterford over the years. And similar to Moose was what Dwight Jarvis did up north, you know, a guy that kind of raced away from the really high publicity places, but was outstanding at Claremont and Monadnock and what we call the upcountry tracks, even though he did, you know, venture down for the Thompson 300 and the Spring Sizzler and races like that. And I mean, Jackie, you know, Jack Arute Jr., who we all know as Jackie, it's impossible to overstate what he's meant to racing in the Northeast, just because of his, you know, announcing at places like Stafford, and obviously how far he took it on the national level. He was part of the broadcast team for something like 26 Indy 500s. You know, never mind all the NASCAR Cup races that he did with MRN and for various TV networks. So, you know, just a stellar group. I mean, it is every year. I'm lucky enough to be on the selection committee for the Hall of Fame, and every year we narrow it down from, you know, 100 and something nominees, sometimes 200 or 300 nominees overall, down to 16 folks, and then we take that 16 and we whittle that group down to the 8 finalists. And I always say every year that the 8 that didn't go in, you know, if you put those guys up in front of the room, it would have been just as weighty a group in terms of their accomplishments. So it's a nice problem to have, you know, trying to whittle this great roster of New England talent down to 8 finalists. But it was a great day.
Now, not to slight any of the classes in the past, but would you say this year's was definitely almost like a stacked heat race from top to bottom, more than so in the past, or at least in recent years?
Oh, maybe. I mean, one thing that was interesting to me that was that this year the class was relatively young as Hall of Famers go. You know, you've got Ricky Craven, Randy LaJoy, Jerry Marquis, Kenny Bouchard, you know, guys who were, I got to stop and think about this now, you know, the eligibility rules say that you've got to be 60 years old or retired for 5 years. Craven isn't 60, LaJoy isn't 60, but they've been retired long enough. Marquis, I'm not sure how old Jerry is, and Kenny just made it on the age requirement. So, you know, what I'm getting at is that in a lot of years, if you've got inductees who are, let's say, 75 or 80 years old, chances are not a lot of folks our age will remember what they did on the racetrack, and also not as many of their peer group in terms of competitors or guys who are, you know, people who are big fans of theirs are probably into racing anymore. You know, a lot of them have passed on. So, you know, that meant that this year's turnout was pretty big because you had a lot of friends and competitors of a lot of these guys, as well as a lot of fans of these guys. So I wouldn't necessarily say it was any more accomplished a group, but it was certainly because they've all been accomplished, and I'd hate to, you know, to throw any shade on some of the past groups, but I think this year's class was more maybe relevant to today's fan, you know, so I can understand that it sort of might seem that way. And, you know, you've got guys that certainly Randy LaJoie with a couple of Busch Series titles, and Ricky Craven with two cup wins, and Kenny Bouchard with a Winston Cup Rookie of the Year title from 1988. You know, it might be more of a nationally known class. And you had Jackie Root in there, and same thing. You know, these people are all known from coast to coast. But, you know, happily every year, I think, has been a really super accomplished group once you get to looking at the bios that the selection committee, gets to read and vote from.
So, switching gears a little bit. Your most recent book chronicled the career of the late Ron Bouchard. The subjects of some of your previous books were the late Ed Flemke Sr. and Richie Evans. Unfortunately, they had passed away years prior to, you know, to you writing the books. The Ron Bouchard book was a work in progress, unfortunately, when illness took him from us. Was there a different feel for you with this particular book, given those circumstances?
Yeah. I mean, and a very slight correction. We hadn't actually started it. Ronnie and I had talked often over the years about doing a book, and there's no doubt that we were going to get to it. But there were times when I was between projects and I said, boy, this is a perfect time to get that book with Ronnie started. And it turned out he was opening a new dealership, and then he'd get that up and running, and we'd see each other somewhere, and he'd say, you know, geez, I think I got a little time now if you want to sit down and talk about that book. But by that time, I was in the middle of something. So we had a lot of swings and misses at getting together to actually write it. And when I finished the book I had done previous to this, which was a book about A.J. Foyt, Mario Andretti, and Richard Petty, that was a perfect point. That was a national book requiring a ton of research. And I said, you know, I kind of want to go, I guess home is the right word, you know, mentally and to my home region. I just wanted to do a book that was almost straight out of my brain rather than straight out of, you know, all these research libraries, because I'd followed around his career for years and covered him for years, and we were pretty good friends. And, you know, it was at that time that, he'd been fighting cancer for quite a while, and it was at that time that everything took a turn for the worse. So we kind of put it on hold for a little while after his death, and a few weeks after he passed, you know, I talked with his wife and his family, and we decided that now was the time to do it. You know, it was going to be, in a perfect world, it was going to be the next book I did anyway, with him here. And it ended up, you know, being a book about Ronnie told through, 20-something different voices rather than a book done in Ronnie's own voice. So, yeah, it did feel differently. It was a little bit tough because we started the interview process with a lot of these people, you know, only a month or two after Ronnie had passed. So the loss was still fresh, not just for family members, but for guys like George Summers and Bugsy Stevens and Dickie Williams. You know, this was a guy who was a big part of their lives and a big part of my own. So it was, you know, more emotional than maybe, you know, a book on a guy who'd been gone for 10 or 20 years. But at the same time, I think it was almost cathartic for a lot of these people. You know, you're able to just sit down with somebody that you know, meaning me, and a tape recorder there, and just kind of tell stories and reminisce and, you know, get off your chest all the things that you would have said, you know, had you been able to, had Ronnie been in, you know, in better health. But, you know, I think because of that, a lot of that emotion comes through in the book, and I think that's a good thing. You know, it's a book that brings out a lot of the highs of his career and really reflects on a great time in New England racing. But it's also full of that emotion that, you know, the connection that a lot of these guys that were veterans, even when Ronnie got to modified racing, you know, I think it shows a lot of the compassion and a lot of the emotion that they felt, you know, for him.
Now, you still follow racing locally and nationally as much as you can from what I see from your social media posts. What do you make of today's racing and the social media aspect of it? And just where do you, if in your mind you feel this way, where do you think it took a wrong turn?
I think social media has been an amazing thing for people who love racing history, because we get to share a lot of photos from the, you know, and you know, I'll gear this toward the Northeast, but, you know, from the Coupe days and the Pinto and Vega days and, you know, Stafford Dirt, you know, I mean, going back as far as you want and to places that aren't here anymore, like Plainville Stadium or Westboro or Danbury Race Arena. It's been great for that. I think it's been a terrible thing for a lot of current tracks, because people are able to just get on. I shouldn't say all terrible. It's been good and bad. It's a blessing because you can find out about things like rainouts, you know, pretty quickly, and find out who won last night someplace if you're not there. But what's bad is that people get to just get on there and badmouth people, ranging from, you know, the guy that won the feature to the promoter to the flagman, with no real recourse. I mean, you know, I had a column in that area for, you know, probably, well, still write a lot of columns, so I mean, probably for 45 years now. But, you know, having said that, you know, in those columns, I've taken a lot of shots at people, but it's different when you're, when you've got your name on it and you kind of are held to standards of, you know, professional journalism, you know, with things like libel laws, and, you know, you've got to get your facts right. You know, you've got to fact check things before you take a shot at somebody. And the difference now is, you know, you can get on Facebook or on a message board under an assumed name, take all kinds of shots at people who have no recourse. There's no guaranteeing whatsoever that the material you're posting is fact checked in any way. So as a consequence, you just get a lot of negativity on there. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff on there, don't get me wrong, but it just seems like sometimes a post about a certain driver will take off, and you see 35 or 40 comments listed below a Facebook post, and naturally you want to click on and read what the comments are. And by the time you get done, you know, you almost want to hang yourself just because of the the sheer negativity of the whole thing. So-and-so's a bum, and so-and-so's an idiot. No, you're an idiot. And, you know, I don't know. It's almost like, and I've used this line in columns before, but it's almost like we think we've all got our own talk show now, and that we've all got to shout our opinions to one another on Facebook and on the various message boards and Twitter and all that. So I do think it's hurt certain aspects of short track racing. You know, there have been at least 3 or 4 documented cases of promoters who claim that they quit the business because of what went on with social media, you know, between fans threatening them, fans calling their wives and kids names, you know, fans harassing them constantly. Now, whether those promoters were, you know, going through hard times anyway and were looking for a way to quit, who knows? But, you know, I know that if I was the subject of some of the posts I've seen about track owners and flagmen and even a lot of drivers, you know, I don't think I'd be too happy. So, you know, you can see where it definitely has a depressing aspect on or a depressing effect on some aspects of racing.
Hey, Bones, it's Sid, and I just wanted to chime in. Obviously, the social media, I've used it. I'd like to think I'd use it in a positive way over the years, and it can easily turn bad.
Sure.
But I also think that a lot of the promoters, they need to embrace it. It must be hard if you're running the business, and like you said, you know, their family members are getting bashed. It's got to be hard to look past that. But on the other flip side, I believe that it's the way of the world these days. And a lot of times, if you're not out on social media or relevant in social media, it can hurt your business. So I think those facts, and I've seen that too, where they say, you know, they're closing down. And sometimes I just think that makes me sad, because I feel like they're just not, they're not handling it right. So despite all the negativity, you have to find that positive way to incorporate it into your track, because I truly believe it's the way of the world now.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's definitely here to stay. But I think it's a real adjustment for, let's say, a promoter in his 50s or 60s who didn't grow up with it. You know, I'm 56 and it's almost a foreign language to me, even though I get a big kick out of it. But like in your case, Sid, you know, with the Waterford videos, I mean, nothing makes me happier than stumbling across one of these videos, you know, a highlights package from a certain race or some of the flashback pieces you've done. And you click on that, and you know, there's times when it'll make my afternoon. If I don't have a lot going and I'm between deadlines, I'll see that, and it'll remind me of, you know, some of those guys from days gone by, including Ronnie or Eddie Flemke or Bugsy or those guys. But then you start reading the comments, and you get about 15 comments into it. And again, you know, it doesn't take long for a really, really positive post like that. You know, just a highlight package from a race that's meant to do nothing but promote, you know, the track, the division, whatever. It doesn't take long for that to turn into, you know, two or three idiots on there calling each other names or calling you names or calling the, you know, the whoever crashed who, you know, calling them a bad name. And it's just, like I said, it just, after a while, it gets depressing because there's no recourse for any of it. You know, if I took somebody to task in a column in Speedway Scene in 1982 or whatever, you know, my name was on it. I had to be at the racetrack the next week. I had to see these people. And that was just part of the drill. You know, they were going to be mad, and that made you extra conscious of the fact that you had to have your facts in line before you wrote anything like that. Because if they were mad, that was one thing, but you didn't want to be wrong. You know, you at least wanted to be on the right side of the argument. And again, you also had the idea that you didn't want to slander anybody or libel anybody, because there are legal ramifications for that, but there are none. Almost none on a Facebook post. You know, you can get removed for certain kinds of profanity, I guess, but some of the stuff I've seen said about, you know, certain owners, drivers, promoters, flagmen, whatever, it's almost, well, like I said, it's sad. I mean, it really can get depressing, and when it's put on there by a guy in, you know, sitting in row 28 of the grandstands that you're not able to argue with, other than on social media. You know, you're never going to be able to sit him down and get your viewpoint heard face to face. That part's tough. So I think it is, you know, I agree with you that it's here to stay. I think all tracks should figure out a way to try to embrace it, even if the only answer is to have, you know, maybe somebody from the track occasionally chime in and give the track's viewpoint when a topic does get really controversial. But I've seen that go the wrong way too, because, you know, a PR person will jump in to try to straighten out an argument, and next thing you know, he's an idiot, and his wife is an idiot, and his family's an idiot. So, you know, you almost can't win. So, I don't know.
I kind of wish in those situations, like, they would take it offline, like, you know, just send a private message, send an email, and hammer it out. Because when the disagreements can be dealt with, but in the public forum, that's not that always the best way.
Yeah, you know, one thing that bothers me is, you know, you look at all of the guys that we know as the legends and the heroes of the sport. You know, you can take, we talked earlier about the guys going into this year's Hall of Fame. Look at everybody that's in the New England Auto Racers Hall of Fame. You know, those guys got to live their lives and run their careers without being, you know, chastised on somebody's Facebook page. And, you know, you have to look at what it does to the legacy of some of these guys, because you know, the guys that race today that get hammered nonstop on various Facebook pages, you know, what's going to happen when they go in the Hall of Fame? I mean, are they going to be remembered as idiots? You know, it's just, there's something, I don't know. I know this is an old fashioned way to look at things, but it was definitely an easier, less complicated way to go racing back in the old days. You know, when you could live your life and not worry about being called out, you know, in some kind of a forum where you had no recourse. You know, I don't know if we'd remember, you know, Bugsy and Eddie and Richie and, you know, Freddie and Ronnie and all of those guys the same, had Facebook been alive then, because maybe they're, you know, we might have all been on Facebook back then tearing them down too. So, like I said, it just gets depressing at times, but I do love the photos and, you know, the historical aspect of it. It's been great from that standpoint, because you can stay up all night just looking at old photographs from all those tracks. So it's definitely good for that.
Now, I picked up my copy of the Ron Bouchard book at the World Series this year. Can you give us any, is there any other people from the Northeast Modified Country that you've been mulling around or have in the works of another book that profiles another legendary driver?
Nothing on anybody up there that's in the works. I mean, I've thought of several over the years. Part of the problem that you run into, you know, you take a guy like Charlie Jozombek, you know, had Islip Speedway still been around, or Freeport Stadium still been around, and you had a couple of healthy venues on Long Island, I mean, Charlie would have been ideal, because he had such a huge fan base on Long Island and a pretty robust fan base, you know, throughout New England and New York and New Jersey as well. But any name that comes rapidly to mind whose life would make a good book, you can think of four or five reasons why it might not be a good business decision to write one, because you just don't have enough places to sell it, or, you know, I'm not a publisher, so that's a question better left to them. But, I mean, it's a struggle. If racing books made a lot of money, if they were easy to do, there'd be more people publishing them, I guess. But, you know, there are names certainly that come to mind. And you know, I'd like to get to the point where I could read some of these books, as opposed to being the guy that has to write them all, in a way. You know, I'd love to read a great book on Major Troyer. It's tough living out where I live now, because, you know, I'm in Indiana. So even to write the Ron Bouchard book meant two or three trips home to New England, and a couple trips to Florida to see guys down there, and trips to Charlotte to see the guys he raced cup cars with. So, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, just waking up and driving down the street and talking to anybody. It's almost a major ordeal when I decide to do one of these. So, you know, I almost wish that somebody out there would also, you know, get involved in the writing of these things, just because it'd be nice to just order one over the phone and sit here and read it. But, you know, there's definitely a lot of guys whose lives would make interesting reading. I've thought about, you know, maybe a series of books with 10 or 12 guys in each book, you know, great careers, colorful people who, you know, whose careers on their own might not justify a book in terms of sales, you know, just because a lot of those fans aren't here anymore. But whose lives, you know, as a collective, you know, work of 10 or 12 chapters about different people, you know, that might be a success too. But it's all, you know, I kind of take a break usually between each book and mull things over and catch up on the magazine work and stuff like that. So I really don't know if there's another one coming on anybody from out there. But like I said, I wish somebody else would sit down and start writing them.
All right, Owens. Well, we really appreciate you coming on tonight. Hopefully some of the younger generation was paying attention when you weighed in on your opinion on social media's effects on racing. And,
yeah, let's hope so. And it's not that I'm that smart. I just get, like I said, it gets really depressed. You don't know whether to, you know, slam your head into a wall or look at the next Facebook post and risk being depressed all over again. So, but it's a great, you know, overall, like we said, it's a great thing. It's a way to share photos and facts and a lot of the history that we all love.
All right. Well, once again, we thank you for coming on. We really appreciate it. And hopefully you have a good off season, and we'll talk to you next year.
Well, thank you guys. I know you got Tony Hirschman III, I guess, or the third or the fourth. I can't remember what he is now, but anyway, Tony's a great guy, and I know you love talking to him, and please tell him I said hi.
All right, we sure will, Bones. Thank you once again.
Good deal, guys. Thank
you, Bones.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Sid. Mark Bones Bercier, author, writer, all around, like I said earlier, aficionado of the sport. Some pretty interesting takes on everything from the Hall of Fame right down to racing today.
Yeah, Bones is great. I felt so when Bones decided to do an interview for our Speedball documentary, I felt like we turned the corner, and it was just an honor to have him. He came back. It might have even been around this time of year in the near banquet. He was coming to New England for something, and he snuck us in between his first stop from the airport and his first stop, and he had a few hours. He came to our house and just told us unbelievably great stories. I learned more than I had ever learned with any other interview. He was a wealth of knowledge and was very encouraging, and has been since then. He's been somewhat of a mentor to me, and he's just a great guy, and obviously has a very positive vibe to him when it comes to racing. So always good to talk to Bones.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Now, our second guest of the evening is going to join us right now. Tony Hirschman III. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Hey, good to be on tonight, guys. How you doing?
Doing well. You and your driver, Kyle Busch, in that Joe Gibbs Racing 18 team clinched a spot in the Final Four, racing for a championship this weekend at Homestead. Just take us through your race weekend with the 18 team and your driver, and also your perspective on that incident between the 20 and 88.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty trying weekend for us. We unloaded, and then race trim, we were decent. I mean, not great. We knew we had work to do in practice on a Friday, and then we switched over to qualifying trim. For whatever reason, we just really struggled in Q trim all weekend. We weren't very good in practice, and then the qualifying, we ended up qualifying 19th, which was one of our worst qualifying of the year. So we knew we had our work cut out for us, and Saturday's practices, the guys, they made a bunch of adjustments and made them actually a bunch of big swings at it, a lot bigger than what we normally do. And we got better, and Kyle was pretty happy with the car. But then on Sunday, you know, just it doesn't matter if it's a mile-and-a-half track, 2 mile track, the cup cars are, you know, the cleaner air you get, the better you're going to be. It doesn't really matter the size of the track. So, you know, we struggled for a while starting 19th and trying to make some ground up. And, you know, we kind of, you know, made up a little bit of ground, but then they had a yellow during a green flag pit sequence, and we ended up getting caught a lap down. So we had to wave around, and then you're in behind everybody again. So just kind of repeated the cycle and worked our way up and kind of stalled out. We were, you know, in around 10th or so, 9th, 10th, 11th, somewhere there. And, you know, we got a couple of those late yellows, and Kyle, like he always does, you know, he just elbows up, got up on the wheel there and made some ground up for us on the restarts, picked a couple spots off, and you know, then Adam did a good job with strategy there. You know, a couple of guys stayed out while we come and got some tires, and then again, Kyle got up on the wheel and picked some spots, and before you know it, we're fifth, and we're fourth, and then we're third with a little fresher tires, and, you know, we're just points watching and doing what we had to do, trying to get in the chase, and then, yeah, at the end with Matt leading, you know, it wasn't looking good. We were still out. We needed, you know, we were tied with Logano, so we needed to have one spot between us and Logano to advance if he led a lap. So we knew what we had, you know, we were kind of stalled out in third. Matt was leading, and Bowman was in second, and Logano was fourth right behind us. And, you know, we needed something to happen. Harvick was working Logano over, so we were really cheering him on, but he kind of leveled out and didn't look too promising for us, and then we had that late yellow, and that just shaped the whole complexion of the race right there. You know, we weren't sure how it was going to shake out. We still needed one spot between us and Logano. If Matt had won, you know, if Bowman had won, then it kind of changed things again. So I'm not very good at math, so luckily we had Adam was on top of it on the pit box. It just kind of, you know, filled Kyle in on what needed to happen or what didn't need to happen. And, you know, the last restart there, it's unfortunate, and I hate it for everybody on the 20 teams, and it stinks to be, you know, a half a lap away from getting the white flag and sealing the race up, and you have a caution come out like that. But, you know, the restart, we started third, Jody was fourth, and we knew we needed one spot between him and us if Matt was going to win the race. So we needed one spot between us, either we needed to pass somebody or somebody had to pass Joey, and we got the green, and yeah, Matt chose the top, and the 88 was on the bottom in front of us in second, and he didn't get a very good start, didn't get a very good launch. So, you know, just kind of did what we normally do. You know, if I see Kyle's got a little bit ahead of steam, I'll let him know where the start-finish line when he crosses this, so we can peek out. And you know, it's hard to beat Kyle Busch on a restart. It doesn't matter who you are. So told him when we got to the line, and he branched off trying to make it three wide on the bottom, trying to get around the 88. Which would have been the spot we needed to lock us in. And, you know, the 88, he come down a little bit to block. And we got into him, and we got, you know, Kyle got out of the gas, got on the brake there and let him slide in. But, you know, the 88 just drove it into one, trying to stay up underneath Matt. And unfortunately, you know, Matt thought he was clear at the time. And the 88 kind of stuffed it back in at the last second there and hooked him. And, unfortunately, Matt ended up in the wall, and the 88 lost some spots, and just through all kind of the aftermath, the scoring loops that they go off of, they put Joey in front of us. And that was kind of it. So we, at that point there, just need to finish it out, something decent, and we did. We were on second behind Joey, so that locked Joey in, and it locked us in on points. So, you know, in the long run, we did what we needed for having, you know, as big of a struggle as we did all day Sunday to end up with a second place finish. It's frustrating to run that bad. But again, you know, they made good choices, good driving, good adjustments, and we ended up with a second place out of it. So that gives you some optimism for when you start off a little bit better and you can work on it where you can have a shot to win.
Now going into Homestead this weekend, obviously the defending Sprint Cup champions from last year, what do you think it'll take to make that a repeat?
Well, that's what you shoot for all year long, is to win a championship. You know, I learned that, you know, going with my dad every week and with the modified stuff. You know, race wins are nice, and you go every weekend hoping to win a race. But you know, end of the season, if you do your job every week of the year, you're in position for a championship, and it's something that you can really kind of, you know, puff your chest out that, you know, race wins, you enjoy them for a little bit, but, you know, before you know it, you're already focused on the next race and what you need to do there.
So the championship,
that's something that you can enjoy and savor for a couple months before you get refocused on the following year. So, we just go into the same game plan like we had last year. I think, equipment wise, we've been really good, really strong all year long. So, just go in with the same game plan we had last year for the weekend. You know, I think what won us the championship last year was, you know, what we did in practice. You know, we kind of had a little different game plan than a lot of the other guys, and they ended up paid off for us in the end. It's really easy here at Homestead, especially the racetrack when it's up on the wall. You know,
with Carl Larson, when he gets up on the wall, or he can make some lap time, it's pretty impressive to watch. So, you know, that's the lap times at, but,
you know, during the race when everybody gets up on the wall, if you can't make your car run on the bottom or in the middle, it's really hard to make any moves. So I think last year
what won us the championship was the, you know, great game plan in practice where
we went in and, you know, we worked on our stuff on the bottom and the middle. We really, I don't think at all, got up on the wall during practice, and that's what it takes in the race. We were really maneuverable and could move around. We could pass guys low, we could pass them high. And
that's what it takes. It's
really easy to fall in love with the speed chart, and you see everybody else put up big numbers, and you're like, wow, that's what we need to run. So then you jump up on the wall, and you kind of lose track of, you know, what the overall plan is. So,
again, that's just something for us to work on and focus, and, you know,
all of our practices are during the daytime, and the race ends at night. So
it's so off of our notes and come with a good piece and tweak on it. You know, be close to start the race, but just try to stay ahead of the track as it shades over and gets dark, and pretty confident with what package we have and what we're going with, and looking forward to.
It's, you know, the hard work's done is getting the Homestead to have a chance to win the championship with where the chase format is. It's so many variables that lead into it. Now it's just, you know, we go out there, we run one race, and we're racing,
you know, the three other guys that we're up against, and it's actually, to me, it feels a little bit simpler than the path to get here.
You're also the spotter for the Kyle Busch Motorsports Camping World Truck Series entry of William Byron. Unfortunately, engine failure robbed you guys of a spot in the truck series chase at Homestead this weekend. What has it been like to work with this impressive young driver? He has just taken that series by storm.
Yeah, it's been awesome this year. It's really been a breath of fresh air. You know, coming in, I didn't really know much about William at all. Obviously, I watched him run the K&E stuff last year. You know, a couple times we were around, whether it was Dover or New Hampshire, and it was really hard for me to judge how good of a driver he was, because every time I saw him race, he was either leading or, you know, kind of checked out on the field. And didn't really get to see him, I think, race anybody where he had to start, you know, in the middle of the pack and kind of, you know, work his way on up through. Every time I saw him, he was up front to start with and kind of dominated and stayed up there. So I didn't really know what we had going in, end of the season. And starting, you know, Daytona's kind of its own world. You know, he had never run a restricted plate track, so it's really hard to judge off of that. You just kind of, you know, run the race and try to make smart decisions there and take care of your stuff to have a shot at the end. Then the second race was Atlanta, and, you know, again, for him not being on a mile and a half there, Atlanta's a challenging track, and, you know, right in the race, you know, he started off and he made up a bunch of spots, and it amazed me how responsive he was to feedback from, you know, whether it was Rudy, the crew chief, or, you know, stuff that I saw where he needed to make up time and where he needed to put the truck. You know, I'd tell him, you know, one lap that he needed to, you know, to wrap the exit of one and two, about two truck lengths longer. And it's like, you know, snap your fingers and he does it, just real responsive. And his discipline's through the roof. So I knew we had, you know, we were going to have a good year. So I know we had the equipment to do it. And that really impressed me with William and how responsive he was and his feedback. And again, just, you know, the discipline that he has, where if you ask him to do something or to try something, he at least tried it. It didn't always work out, but, you know, he definitely has all the talent in the world. And it was, you know, a blast to work with him this year. Just unfortunately, again, you know, some people are for the chase, some are against the chase, and it has its pluses and minuses. And, you know, unfortunately, our situation there, and I've had numerous people come up to me, whether it was last week or this week, kind of voice their, I don't want to say frustration, I guess, that, you know, William doesn't have a chance to run for the Drivers' Championship next year or this weekend, because, you know, we've had, you know, we had six wins and led the series points most of the year. And, again, just, yeah, as good of a job as he's done, as good a job as the team's done, it really is heartbreaking to, you know, where he's not one of the four to go after it this weekend and have a shot at the championship that he deserves. And I think everybody in the sport that watches the truck series, they know that he was definitely one of the bright spots this year as far as driver. The team was one of the strongest ones all season. So, you know, unfortunately, he's not eligible for the Drivers' Championship, but the way the chase worked out, we're eligible for the Owners' Championship with the 9 truck. So going to go into this weekend, same thing, you know, race hard and race smart and you know, try to at least, you know, bring home half the puzzle there with the Owners' Championship on the truck side.
Now, you also have another unique opportunity this weekend besides the Sprint Cup Series Championship, and you just mentioned the Truck Series Owners' Championship. You also have a shot at the Xfinity Series Owners Championship with the 18 team. Matt Tift is your driver this weekend. Just take us through your season with the 18 Xfinity Series team.
Yeah, I've really been blessed with, you know, just being matched up with successful people. Obviously, you know, being born as you know, with Tony Hirschman as my dad and going with him every weekend and watching him race and win races and, you know, all the accomplishments that he had and you know, I started spotting for him in 1994, and, you know, then we got some championships on the modified side, which was, you know, that's just watching him and learning how to approach each weekend. And also how to approach each weekend with the,
you know, with the opportunity to go after a championship at the end of the season. I definitely learned a lot there. So it, you know, with the 18 team, we've had a great year. We've won, the team itself has won 12 times. You know, we had, obviously Kyle's run the car a bunch, and he's got 10 wins, but, they also got a win with, Denny Hamlin with, he run, 2 races, I think. And then, you know, Matt Tift has run a bunch, and, you know, a lot of people are aware of Matt's situation, earlier in the year. It was just supposed to be Kyle and him splitting the car, with Denny having like one race. But, you know, Matt had, he had a back issue, and he went to the doctors to work on the back issue. And while he was there getting tests, they actually found a tumor on his brain. So he had, brain surgery, about the middle of the season. So it really is impressive to watch him, you know, as a young guy, come back and fight as hard as he has to get back in the seat. And, you know, he's really been running a lot as far as he's run the truck series and run a bunch of the Xfinity races here at the end of the year. So it's, you know, it's a great opportunity for him. It's a great opportunity for the team to go to Homestead this weekend. And again, with Kyle running so many races, we're not eligible for we didn't have one particular driver that's eligible for the driver's championship, but the, you know, the team's performed and they deserve, their recognition. So it's nice to go with a chance to win the owner's championship there with the 18 and, you know, with Matt behind the wheel, it'll be a tough weekend. We're up against like the Penske 22 there. I think Ryan Blaney is going to run that this weekend, and Suarez out of the JGR camp, and Elliott Tyler. So it'll be a tough weekend, but, you know, again, it's just like we do on the Cup side and on the truck side. We'll go in and take care of, you know, our stuff. You can't really focus too much on what the opposite, you know, the competition is doing. You just go in and worry about your stuff and make your stuff as good as you possibly can in practice. And you know, hopefully the racing guys are with you during the race and you can race your way to, you know, and get the end result, what everybody deserves there on the 18 team.
Now, you started to mention how your career in spotting started, you know, working with your dad, obviously, way back when. And what a lot of the listeners might not know, your first real big break was in the IRL series, and you actually spotted for several drivers in the IRL series before you eventually your path brought you back to stock cars. Just kind of for the listeners, give us a summation, I guess, of how your career bloomed.
Yeah, like I said, just, you know, I started spotting for my dad and, you know, did that for a few years. And in 1998, and when I first started spotting, and that's what I tell a lot of people that are, you know, looking at doing it or like doing it. But, you know, I tried to do it as much as I possibly could. So if we were at, you know, Thompson or whatever, I'd try to, you know, I'd spot for my dad, but I'd try to spot for an SKA or spot for a late model or, you know, the E-Series was around us, trying to spot for them. So I tried to do it as much as I possibly could. And in 1998, we were in New Hampshire with the IRL series. And one of the teams, Dick Simon Racing, was looking for a spotter that weekend. And kind of between me asking around, looking for something, and, you know, they were searching for a spotter. And, you know, they talked to some of the NASCAR officials. And the NASCAR officials kind of, you know, referenced me or you know, with my dad, so they asked me to do it that weekend, and spotted there, and, you know, they liked me enough to where they asked me to come back again the next week, which I think was the next race may have been Dover, so I went down to Dover and did that, and, you know, and just kind of kept going back and doing all the races. I know the first flight I was on airplane ride was to Charlotte for the IRL race, and I got on the plane and sat down like, man, I'm really made it. I get to go on an airplane to go to a racetrack. So it kind of went from there. I spotted for, you know, Dick Simon Racing. Finished out 98, and then they had Stefan Gregoire come on as a driver in 99. So I spotted for him for a few years, and, you know, Dick Simon kind of shut his team down. They were looking for sponsorship, and nothing was coming about, so he shut his team down. And again, just, you know, a good break. Dick's son, who was our crew chief there at Dick's team, he was actually dating Sarah Fisher's PR person, and this kind of worked out where that's when she landed a full-time ride there with Dreier Reinbold Racing, and she was looking for a spotter, so it just happened that, you know, that Richie and them were out, and he's like, oh, well, I don't think we're going to run anymore, so, you know, Hirschman spots for us and does a really good job. So I started spotting for Sarah that year and spotted for her for, I think, 3 years. And just contacts we made there. My teammate at Dreier Reinbold as a spotter was Jeff Dickerson. He spotted for Robbie Buell when I spotted for Sarah. Well, he kind of did some managing with some different drivers, and he was dabbling in some NASCAR stuff, and he ended up going full-time NASCAR racing. He got out of the IRL, and then you know, Sarah, her full time opportunity kind of comes in there with Dreier Reinbold, where she was just doing a few races. So, you know, Jeff was over on the NASCAR side there and had me fill in a little bit with some different teams on companion weekends, and you know, I did some spotting for, you know, Martin Truex when he was at the his chance to do it at the time, which is the DEI. So again, just, you know, started doing that, and then kind of got brought into the NASCAR full time, and you know, did a few IRL races here and there, but just started making connections on the NASCAR side. And again, just like anything you do, it doesn't matter what your job is, you try to do the best job that you can, and try to make a good reputation for yourself, and do your best every weekend. And that's just kind of been my path. You know, I was lucky enough to do it for my dad and have some success, and which led me to the IRL stuff, and again, over there, just making some good connections and trying to do a good job for everybody. So being in NASCAR full-time, and I started in 2006 with my first full-time season on the NASCAR side, and I've been doing it since.
Now, you know, obviously, as you stated, you started in the modifieds with your dad. You're still very, very passionate about the modified community. I know you spot whenever you get a chance. You follow all the goings-ons and, you know, comment on social media and stuff. What is your take on this merger, and what is your take on, you know, these announcements the past few days with basically four teams and drivers, you know, teams dissolving and drivers in search of rides?
Yeah, I know a lot of my friends, they give me some ribbing about some of my posts on social media, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent sometimes. But, you know, the modified, that's what I grew up going to races and with, you know, with my family, and I love it. To me, there's no better race car on the, you know, on the planet than a NASCAR modified, and it's just fun to go watch. The people in it are awesome, and, you know, just have so many friends, and you know, selfishly, I want the series to do well. And, you know, my brother races enough where, you know, but he kind of dabbles in a little bit of everything. He doesn't really have one alliance. You know, he'll run some ROC races. He'll run the, you know, the Tri-Track series. He'll run the NASCAR series when he can. So it's, you know, and I have a lot of friends, again, you know, doing this NASCAR stuff. A lot of guys that run the Southern Modified Tour for NASCAR. And, you know, I kind of see it from both sides, you know, what some of their grievances were. And they kind of feel like they're, you know, the quote-unquote merger is more than just shutting down the Southern Series. But it's a tough thing. I understand kind of where everybody's at. And, you know, a lot of the, if you, you know, reading all the comments, you know, between, you know, Jimmy Blewett and Bob Garbarino not going to be together next year, and Santos not being sure what the Tenios are going to do, and, you know, it's tough because you're already, like I said, you're pretty much into your off season by a few months, and you know, racing the modified tour is, any of the modified tours is not a cheap proposition. So, you know, people, you know, they need help between sponsorship or just trying to come up with a game plan on what they need to do to be able to make it through the following season. You know, you can't bank on, you know, obviously Matt's been fortunate enough, you know, he's won a lot of the you know, the big money races, and you know, that he's had a lot of success in those races. But, you know, again, in his shoes, you can't bank on winning 10 races. It doesn't matter how many you run. You can't bank on winning 10 races or 15 races a year. You know, you may have the racing luck's not with you.
you can go windless and, you know, tear your car up a few times or, you know, one blown motor or something like that. It can really set you behind the eight ball. So, you know, a lot of these teams are waiting from NASCAR standpoint for them to come out with a schedule, which it's not out yet. You know, you hear rumblings about where they're talking about going, but, you know, you're almost into December and there's no schedules out yet. And again, you know, if they're going to add some, if it's going to be a merger where the northern guys are going to have to go south or the southern guys are going to have to go north to run for the full season, you need some sort of purse structure so you know what you need is even feasible to go and run those races, to run the full season. So, you know, I know that's why a lot of the Southern Tour teams, they've talked about running the past modifieds down there, just trying to stay local. You know, they may not pay quite as well as what a NASCAR Tour race would pay up north. I know the Southern races didn't pay what the Northern races pay. But, there's a lot of racers that are here in the country between the Northeast and, you know, a lot of the Southern Modified guys. You know, I talked to Burt Meyer at the Martinsville, just some of the stuff that we talked about. You know, they're racers. They'd love to go race as much as they possibly can, but you can only take a hit so many times in a row. You know, if you're racing and, you know, you win a race and you can barely break even with what you spent for that weekend, well, that's fine. Even the races that if you win and you can make a little bit of money you can spend for that weekend, well, the next week when you go back and, you know, you don't fare so well or, you know, you tear right front off and you finish in the teens, well, you've lost everything you've earned that past weekend with the win. You gave that back plus some. So, I know that's a big contention. You know, the guys are just waiting for a schedule to come out between for NASCAR and see what their purse structure is going to be to even feasible. So I know there's a lot of people that are not committing right now, but there's really nothing to commit to because you can't, you know, they know what they can afford to spend during the course of the year. And if it's a lot more traveling and if the person don't want the traveling, well, they just won't run a full-time tour. No, they'll take more shows around home, but that's, you know, the economics of the sport. You gotta be smart. You can't run yourself in the ground just for the sake of saying, well, I went and ran all the races. You know, you got to be smart and can have some money in the bank that you can, you know, if you don't fare well or you have a problem, that you can go racing again the following weekend.
All right, Tony. Well, we really thank you for coming on and taking the time to be on the show with us. Good luck this weekend on all three championships that you're shooting for there. But before we let you go, do you have anybody you want to thank for getting you into this point in your racing career?
Yeah, obviously, you know, it starts with family. I definitely got to thank my dad. That's the main reason why I'm in the sport. And you know, obviously with Matt's successes, you know, we both learned from the absolute best that the modified world has to offer is our dad. And it's, you know, pretty impressive to see his work ethic, what he did on the track, but what a lot of people don't see is all the work that he does, you know, in the shop, and that's where races are won, are in the shop. So, and that's, and Matt's really learned that, and to see how hard they work. That's a big reason for my dad's success when he was racing, a big reason for Matt's success. And obviously, I've never turned a lap and driven, but watching my dad at work, I sort of know what needs to be done to have a successful weekend and to put yourself in position at the end of the year to be able to run for championships. And, you know, I know last year when we won the championship there at Homestead, I called my dad, talked to him. Obviously, he was really happy. And, you know, to me, the first thing he said, he watched the race. He's like, man, that's how I would have run that race, the way Kyle run it. So coming from my dad, that's as big of a compliment as you could possibly get, is my dad saying, you know, he run that race like I would have run it. So, that meant all the world to me to hear him say that. And I know he was pulling for us. And, you know, the difference between my dad as a driver and Kyle Busch as a driver is pretty polar opposite. My dad's just cool, calm, collected, and Kyle just up on the wheel and 120% every lap. So, again, for him to say that about Kyle, and trust me, we've talked to Kyle about trying to, you know, just run the races and let the races come to him. And, you know, and slowly but surely he's figuring it out. And, you know, it was really impressive last year and obviously paid off for the championship. So hopefully take those lessons and we'll go back at it this week and hopefully make it two in a row.
All right, Tony. Well, once again, we really thank you for coming on and we wish you luck this weekend, bud. And we'll talk to you probably at Wall Stadium.
All right. Sounds good, guys. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Sid. Tony Hirschman III definitely made his bones around here, as they say, racing with his dad and racing in the modified community. And like you said, got his break in IRL and then went back to stock cars and NASCAR world. And now he's defending Sprint Cup champion spotter and going for two in a row.
Yeah, that's definitely pretty cool. Anytime there's somebody with connections to the modified country doing well down south, that's always a good thing.
All right, Sid. Well, originally you were supposed to be a guest tonight, and we turned you into a guest co-host because of Mike's work issue. So, you know, we had our typical questions lined up for you as a guest. Basically, we're going to, you know, abbreviate those and just have – I just kind of have one question for you I wanted to ask you. 2016 was another atypical season at the London Waterford Speed Bowl. Sean Monahan announced his resignation after two seasons in his role as the promoter. The race director position was at times in turmoil, but as always, the racing on the track was excellent. What's your thoughts overall on the 2016 season at the Speed Bowl?
Yeah, it was a notch down, I would say, from the excitement of 2015 when we were all just thrilled to not have to worry about the word foreclosure. Obviously, all the renovations that took place at the facility in the beginning of the year was great to see an opening day. You know, I still think Sean did some good things. And I wrote in my my year in review rant and review there, he just looked exhausted. And you know, I don't know if he still carried the same excitement and enthusiasm. I'm sad to see him go. I was kind of hoping that it would all kind of work out better, but considering that he didn't, like I said, he just seemed exhausted. So for that reason alone, it's you know, as a friend of his, I'm glad to see him walking away. But again, you know, here we are again. We kind of don't know who the promoter is. We don't really know what's going on with the race director. And like you said, the racing is still excellent. So. I don't know. I guess it's par for the course. Yeah. I hope that there's more good racing and you know, I have faith that, you know, Bruce has a plan that he's going forward with and that'll all work out.
Now, what can we look forward to, during the off season from, Sid's Ball Productions and next year from Sid's View?
Yeah. Next year, Sid's View, you know, I don't think it's going to be anything too different. But, you know, I'll think about Sid's View in a little while. I need some time to get back into this documentary. I'll be posting some links to the Speedball History page to stay active with my with the Ball Productions Facebook page. And then I just got to get deep into this editing with the documentary and get it done. So, no end date. Yeah, but I got to keep plugging on it to get closer to it. So I'll definitely be busy and be sharing some stuff along the way from the history site, speedballhistory.com. So.
All right, Sid. Well, once again, thank you very much for filling in tonight for Mike and his time of need. And, you know, thanks to our guests, Bones Brasseur, Tony Hirschman III. Thanks to Victory Lane Radio, Eric LaFleche. As always, the listeners. And we'll be back again next Tuesday night.
Well, that's it for this week on the Racers Rewind. Join hosts Glenn Carcitti and Mike Soluca each and every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. only on the Victory Lane Radio Network, presented by Anytime Realty, empowered, loud, and proud by the HD Radio Network in Austin, Texas. Keep up with all things Racers Rewind by going to the VLR Facebook page, facebook.com/VL Radio Show.
HD Radio Network.com. HD